From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, yes, those Friday into Saturday morning open lines. So I leave Los Angeles for a few weeks to come to St. Louis, and every time I'm on a plane, I'm saying, well, I probably dodged some earthquakes. Not so. We got hit with a big one in the St. Louis area. As a matter of fact, it was 127 miles west of St. Louis, but it was a big one, and we felt it. As a matter of fact, right after the program, leaving the cave, I got home, jumped into bed, and I swear to God, the entire house was shaking. I mean, shaking for 20 seconds. The roof was moving, and I thought for a moment, after talking to Whitley Strieber, aliens had landed on my roof. This thing just kept going. I've never been in an earthquake that big. You know, even being out in Los Angeles for 5 years, the biggest I was ever in was a 2.4. This was a 5.2. Residents across the Midwest were awakened by this 5.2 magnitude earthquake that rattled skyscrapers in Chicago's Loop and homes in Cincinnati, but appeared to cause no major injuries or damage, though some experts are saying this could be a prelude to a big one here at the New Madrid Fault. The quake, just 4:37 a.m. Central Time, was centered 6 miles from West Salem, Illinois, 45 miles from Evansville, Indiana, and again, 127 miles from St. Louis, where I am right now. It was also felt in distant cities, Milwaukee, Des Moines, Atlanta. Just absolutely incredible. Well, I called some friends at CNN, and I said, look, if you want to put me on, put me on, and they did. And we talked for a few moments about truly what I had witnessed. The strange thing about the whole thing was that the birds were chirping like crazy. Geologist Jim Berkland, of course, he knows all about earthquakes, and he predicted this one. Jim, I'm finally in one. Finally.
Well, join the club. That's great.
I'm not sure I want any more membership here.
Well, you only need one, really, to But there is this snobbery in the earthquake club that I encountered when I felt my first one of 5.3. And this lady, I was really reveling in it because it was over. And I'd gotten through it, and I wandered up to the neighbor, and this gal said, nothing like we had in Eureka 3 years ago. And she had a 6.5, and she really lorded it over me, and I felt really humbled.
Jim, these birds were chirping like crazy yesterday. I don't know if they were chirping before the event occurred, which was about 30 minutes or so after I got off the air, but they went nuts. Did you have any chance to check to see if there were any missing animal reports in the Midwestern area?
Not that I've been waiting for that. I really have. Now, I'll bet there was a silence in the birds just before the quake. There's usually a kind of a deadly silence of insects and all sorts of critters, and then with the quake, it really breaks out, so you see the vast difference. I think if you get any callers tonight in the area, they, I'm sure, will have plenty of animal stories to tell you. And I've had a couple that...
And you predicted this, didn't you?
Yes, in my April newsletter. It wasn't that precise, because I just said there'd be... Here it is. There will be a rare quake of at least 4 magnitude east of the Mississippi during the first half of April. Well, it was actually 53 hours late to be in the
first half. Oh, Jim, how could you be off by so much?
Yeah, shame on me. But we were hopping back from Maryland. We were flying back across the country to the west, and we stopped in Chicago and missed your quake by about 14 hours.
It's a strange feeling, I've got to tell you. Now, some geologists are saying that this could be a prelude to a bigger one to come. What do you think?
Well, we just asked that by Cal Ori, you know, that wrote the book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, Jim Berkland.
About you, that's right.
Geologist, yes. And she asked that same question, and I said, you know, I have to give it about a 50% chance for having a greater, because you actually had at least 3 quakes there. The second strongest was 4.6, and in between you had a 3.4.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, Jim. I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. over the weekend, so I escape this area. All right, okay. Jim Berkland, the geologist. You can get information on Jim's website by going to coasttocoastam.com. In New York, a homeless man has come forward with two sets of confidential Ground Zero blueprints that he says were dumped in a lower Manhattan trash can. The man brought the Freedom Tower plans to the New York Post, which says the 150-page schematic is marked secure document confidential. The documents are dated October 5, 2007. They contain plans for each floor, the thickness of the concrete core wall, and the location of air ducts, elevators, electrical systems, and support columns. The agency that owns the World Trade Center site, the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, calls it a serious security lapse. A passenger who left his seat to pray in the back of a plane before it took off, ignoring flight attendants' orders to return, was removed by an airport security guard. The Orthodox Jewish man, who wore a full beard, a black hat, and a long black coat, stood near the lavatories and began saying his prayers while the United Airlines jet was being boarded at John F. Kennedy International Airport. When the flight attendants urged the man who was carrying a religious book to take his seat, he ignored them. Now, two friends who were seated tried to tell the attendants that the man couldn't stop until his prayers were over in about 2 minutes. Now, when the man finally did stop praying, he explained that he couldn't interrupt his religious ritual and wasn't going to be rude. But the attendants summoned a guard to remove him, and off he went. Citicorp delivered yet another quarter of devastating results Friday, this time losing more than $5 billion due to troubles in its fixed income business and higher consumer credit costs, adding that it would cut an additional 9,000 jobs. The New York-based company also recorded more than $15 billion in write-downs, with the lion's share coming from subprime-related direct exposures. A Russian man woke up after a night of heavy drinking to find a knife wedged into his skin between his shoulder blades. The 53-year-old said he could not remember details of the night after being awoken by his wife, who noticed the knife protruding out of his back. The electrician reportedly had an argument with his drinking buddy, passed out, and was stabbed at the factory where he works. In London, fortune tellers, mediums, and spiritual healers marched on the home of the British Prime Minister at Downing Street to protest against new laws they fear will lead them to being persecuted and prosecuted. The organizers say that replacing the Fraudulent Mediums Act of 1951 with new consumer protection rules will remove key legal protection for genuine mediums. They think skeptics might bring malicious prosecutions to force spiritualists to prove in court that they can heal people, see into the future, or talk to the dead. Psychics also fear that they will have to give disclaimers describing their services as entertainment or as scientific experiments with unpredictable results. Well, they call it the Magic Mountain, but what really is happening inside of Mount Shasta? In a moment, a special guest on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Zandoni grew up in the streets of New York City, surrounded by people of many backgrounds, ethnicities. This aroused curiosity about the human condition and need to understand just what makes people choose the path they do. Such was the case when he came across the legend of J.C. Brown, the man who claimed to have discovered a lost city in Shasta Mountain with hidden treasure and the remnants of a legendary society. The body of his work includes the following. Sindoni says, I am, I said, the Planet X Factor, Trailer Park, Temp Agency, and the legend of J.C. Brown. Stephen Zandoni. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
Good evening, George. How are you tonight?
Good. I just want to pronounce it again. Ethnicities. There you go. I got
yes,
it out.
You've got it, yes.
Mount Shasta, called the Magic Mountain. How come?
Well, Native Indians claim that our descendants, our true descendants, were from the Lemurian continent of Mu that sunk 15,000 years ago near the Pacific Ocean. And these ancient people went into the mountain to live in the hollows of the earth and still live there today.
Now, the legend of J.C. Brown. Tell me about this.
Well, initially, I was looking for a story to write for a screenplay. And I went on the internet and I saw The Legend of J.C. Brown. So I decided to read it, and I was fascinated by it. And being fascinated by it, I decided I was going to spend 2 weeks in a New York public library to research the clues that I had read in the legend.
Now, for some people who might not know about Mount Shasta, it's a majestic mountain. It's part of the Cascade Mountain Range. It is in Northern California, 45 miles from the Oregon border. And it has an extinct volcano, which rises to a height of, what, over 14,000 feet, Stephen, isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it's one of the largest volcanic peaks here in the continental United States. A rare place indeed. What is the magic of this mountain?
Well, the magic is that the Lemurian people, who are our true descendants of North America, have high powers. They are mystical people and have the power of telepathy, and they have technology that's far beyond that we've ever had on this planet that we know of. And these people took that technology with them after their continent perished and decided to go underground, and that's where they are today.
Why Mount Shasta?
Well, they said that Mount Shasta was one of the first places that was inhabited on the earth, so it's a holy place.
Okay, now are they still there?
Yes.
How far deep?
Well, initially they were 11 miles deep, and that was initially at the time J.C. Brown discovered one of the villages there that he had encountered. But they are probably many miles from there now, you know, but that was where he had discovered remnants of an ancient civilization.
Is it just one opening there, Stephen, or many?
Well, there's one opening there, but there are many openings throughout the world that can be accessed to reach the hollows of the earth.
Well, that's true. Now, in this particular case, J.C. stumbled into it. How long did he stay there?
What happened was J.C. Brown turns up in 1934 at the office of the editor of the Stockton Record newspaper. And he tells a story to the editor that 30 years before, while working for the Lord Cowdray Mining Company of England, he was employed as a geologist to look for gold and prospect in Mount Shasta. He claimed to them that in a second trip up there, he noticed a rock formation that didn't seem right. And on further inspection, he started to dig. And upon digging, he noticed there was a cave. He went in with his lantern and mining paraphernalia, and 3 miles into the tunnel that spiraled downward within the mountain, he found gold mining ore from a civilization that had mined earlier. He decided to go deeper, and he went 8 miles deeper, which now he's 11 miles depth. And when he got to 11 miles depth, he saw a village and with streets. And as he continued on, he found rooms and chambers. And when he found the rooms and chambers, what he noticed, there were artifacts there from ancient civilizations. He found gold. He found hieroglyphics. He found plates that were had drawings on them, tempered steel, spears, and other objects made of gold. And he knew he was onto something. Upon further discovery, he came across other rooms that turned into chambers with places of worship. He found 13 statues that were made of copper and gold, and a sun that was designed from golden streamers with metal that we don't even today have the ability to create. He noticed while he was in his room that things were strewn about, and it looked as if people were there, but they must have left at the spur of the moment. So he realized that, you know, this place had been occupied. He then went into another chamber, and this is where he made a rather bizarre discovery. He just discovered 27 skeletons, the smallest of which was 6.5 feet, and the largest of which was 10 feet tall.
Jeez, giants.
Yes. Then he discovered there were two of the bodies were mummified, but each were clad in ornate robes, and he thought that they would be their kings and queens. So he made an unbelievable discovery while he was in this mind shift. Now, after he made this discovery, he decided he was going to cover up the tunnel and conceal it and that someday in the future he would return, and he would mark the entrance on a map so he knew where it was, mm-hmm. and then later he would return with enough people so that way they can catalog the items, document it, and then he would register his find.
But he didn't want anyone else to stumble into it.
Correct, yes.
Okay, okay. Did he ever go back?
Yes, he did. In the legend, he claimed that after he met with the editor of the newspaper, the editor of the newspaper introduced him to Harry Noyes Pratt. And Harry Noyes Pratt was a director of the Hagen Museum in Stockton, California.
And what time period were we talking about here,
this
Steve?
Was then 1934.
Okay.
So he shows up 30 years later in the office of the editor, convinces the editor that, you know, he has an unbelievable find for the lost continent of Lemuria. The editor now gets the Hagen Museum curator involved, and they grill him, they question him, and they both are under the opinion that this man is telling the truth. So they then enlist a man by the name of John C. Root, who is a retired printer, and John C. Root becomes the organizer for the group. So then for the next 6 weeks, starting in May, April through April 34 till June 19th of that year in 1934, they were holding meetings at John C. Root's home twice a day. Now, in those meetings, J.C. Brown was telling them of the artifacts and things he had found, and he needed 80 people to go up to Mount Shasta with him to on the expedition. And he told them the expedition would be done at his expense. He told them at that time he was worth $40 million, and he provided a boat for everybody to go up there. Now, on June 19th, before they were supposed to go, he told everyone there that if they wanted to back out, they could.
Right.
But he had been kidnapped in some of his trips going back up to the mountain, and he almost lost his life. And he said later in life, after he retired from the Lord Cowdrey Mining Company, his family wanted to come up to the mountain with him, you know, to find the claim.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, once he told his family, they started to die mysteriously one by one, and then he had another accident where he was almost killed. So he was fearful for his life. But the curator of the museum wanted to see some sort of evidence to prove that he actually did find something up in Mount Shasta. So J.C. Brown at that point told him that he had a bank vault in a Texas bank with photographs and papers to prove his, you know, his claim was correct. And the curator, Harry Noyes Pratt, said, well, I want to see those before I even, you know, venture up there with you. So I'll provide them for you later today because I have them. Well, later today, which was June 19th of 1934, 80 people waited at 1 p.m. at the Stockton Harbor. They waited, but nobody showed up. J.C. Brown never showed up.
Oh,
people waited about 12 hours, George, and at that point they got rather concerned and they called in the Stockton police. So now the Stockton police come in and they do their investigation, but they could find no J.C. Brown, no hide or hair of him. They could find no crime committed because they, after interviewing the 80 people, they found out he never took a dime. And the people were adamant about the fact that they believed that this J.C. Brown was worth $40 million and that he would have provided a yacht, but something made him change his mind.
And we don't even know if that was his real name now, do we?
Correct, right. Now, after reading this story, George, I thought he was a charlatan. I thought this was a con. I figured I'm going to be writing about a con man.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I was going to spend 2 weeks in the New York Public Library with the 8 clues that I read on the internet. And I got from the Stockton Record, I got the original newspaper article that was written on June 19th of 1934. So I went with that and what I read on the internet, and I took those 8 clues that I had, and I went to the New York Public Library, and I started to research what information I had to see if I was going to come up with something or it would still remain a legend after my couple weeks of research.
What did you find?
Well, interesting enough, the first clue that I had was the Lord Cowdrey Mining Company. So I decided to see if there was a man by the name of Lord Cowdrey. Lo and behold, I Googled the name. There was a Lord Cowdrey.
Hmm.
Initially, his birth name was Sir Wheatman Pearson. Now, Wheatman Pearson is now the Pearson Company. I believe they're Penguin Books. They were
a
big oil conglomerate. And I said, well, wait a minute. I've got the guy. And then I looked a little further, George. I says, well, let me see the age. Well, J.C. Brown was supposedly about 79 years old when he arrived in the office of the editor in 1934.
79? He was way up there. Stay with us, Stephen. We're going to come back, finish up the rest of our story with you, and then we'll take phone calls with you, too, because I'm sure you're fascinated with the Mount Shasta story. We'll be back. If you know anything about Mount Shasta, check in with us. Say this weekend, it's none other than Ian Punnett. Ian, how are you?
George, I got to admit, I don't play a lot of Johnny Mathis bumpers, but that was pretty good.
That was a good one. It's an old favorite of mine. And,
very lovely.
It kind of hits you in the heart. And speaking of getting hit, I was right in the middle of an earthquake in this morning.
You were? Were you?
Yeah.
Were you in Illinois? Were you in St. Louis?
100. I'm in St. Louis now.
Oh, are you really? You weren't too far away from the New Madrid, huh?
No, not at all. We were 127 miles away from the epicenter, and my kids all felt it in their houses, and kind of weird. I tell you, anyways, I got onto CNN this morning, and I did a phoner like you did during the bridge collapse.
Really, right. Yeah. And, in the end, after they checked it everywhere, there wasn't any damage, any significant damage or anything, right? No building fell or anything.
Yeah, but it could be a prelude to something else, though, Ian.
Oh, exactly. Oh, I lived in Nashville for a long time, and New Madrid runs really close to Nashville, and they've been sort of keeping an eye on it for a while. And at one time, there were some predictions from some professor at Vanderbilt University or something that it was the big one was coming, and it never did. And he said it's overdue by, 100 years or 200 years or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, they think at any moment now something big could break. Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know that you'd gone back to the Midwest. That must be weird.
I left L.A. to get away. Yeah, I left L.A. to get away from possible earthquakes, right?
Exactly. And then go to St. Louis. How about that?
The good Lord works in mysterious ways.
Yeah, well, I tell you, there's an interesting thing about the good Lord on Sunday night. We're going to have one of the women who has been inside of these extremist Mormon cults who lived in a polygamous relationship, who was raised in polygamy, who has written a book after escaping. And she really lays out exactly what happens, everything step by step that happens inside of these cults. And she'll be talking about that Sunday night when I'm filling in. And then tomorrow night, I know you love having Steve Quayle on, so I'm probably stealing them from you. But
no, I don't.
Did you see these stories, really interesting stuff about how survivalism is making a big revival because of the economy? And I know something that you talk about, gold and all of the economic implications, but with some of the things that have happened in South America and some of the things that are happening here, the new people who have never before thought about what they need to do to survive economically are building little walls around their fortunes or properties to kind of protect them. And that's what we'll be talking about tomorrow night with Steve Quayle, this new kind of survivalist out there and what many of us might have to consider doing.
Should be a great weekend. Thanks, Ian.
Thanks, George. God bless.
Ian Punnett, Coast to Coast AM, live on this Saturday and Sunday. We'll be back in a moment. We'll continue the story of Mount Shasta with Stephen Sindone and your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie as we talk about the legend of J.C. Brown and Mount Shasta with Stephen Sindone. Stephen, you're talking about the clues, and the first being, of course, the mining company. Go ahead.
Right. Well, the first clue was the Lord Cowdery Mining Company. And lo and behold, the company did exist. I was able to Google it, and there was the company. I found out that the man in the company was named Lord Cowdery, but he wasn't named Lord Cowdery initially. He was, as I mentioned earlier, born Sir Wheatman Pearson. So after learning this, I went to the New York Public Library, the genealogy department. But after learning this on their computer upstairs, I went downstairs in the genealogy department, and I started to go through birth records, death records, border crossings, marriage, and anything I could on Sir Wheatman Pearson to find out if he, in fact, was the J.C. Brown. Well, the first thing I learned, he was about the right age. I went to the border crossings, and I found about 10 border crossings into the states. I found a couple through Mexico, and I was looking for 1904 specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I found 1904 coming through Laredo, Texas border. When I found that on the manifest, I noticed that he came in with two other civil engineers and J.B. Body, who's also a civil engineer. So those names, J.B.'s Body's name stuck out. The other two civil engineers I was going to research later. I came up a little roadblock there because in that library they didn't have his death records. So I went to the Mormon church, tried to get it. I couldn't get it. I then went to the Science Library on 34th Street, and I was able to find his autobiography. Once I was able to pull the autobiography for Lord Cowdrey, I discovered that he died in 1927. So now that kind of put me at an obstacle course because the man I'm looking for shows up in 1934.
Mm-hmm.
So I go back to the counter and I ask a woman by the name of Marguerite Nealon, who works there at the Science Library at 34th Street, if she could find me a book on the American Society of Civil Engineers, because in the autobiography of Lord Cowdrey, it mentioned he was a civil engineer. And I'm thinking, well, whoever this man is has to be a civil engineer because Lord Cowdrey came in 1904, just like the man in the legend J.C. Brown claims. But I couldn't find him coming in 1907. So I said, well, he had to have told somebody, or maybe it was somebody other than the initial engineers that he brought over on the first trip. Well, Marguerite Nealon found this book for me. She said, you know, it's funny you say that, but a week ago I came across a book on American Society of Civil Engineers. She says, wait right here, I'll get it for you. So she went and got it. I thumbed through the book and noticed that Lord Cowdrey had died in 27, as I had learned. And I then I looked further and I found three other lieutenants that he had who were all civil engineers. And I looked at the names to see if the names matched the 1904 crossing through Laredo, Texas. One of the four names matched. It was J.B. Body.
J.B. Body, yeah.
Now, okay. J.B. Body was actually John Benjamin Body, which I learned through the microfilm. So now I wanted to study more of J.B. Body. So what I did then, I then got another microfilm to read, and I was able to find his memoirs through the American Society of Civil Engineers, which put his death at May 23rd of 1940. So here it is. I have a man who was born in 1867, who was about 70 years old at the time, 1934, that the man shows up at the Stockton editor's mm-hmm. office. So I've got a man who's late in age, who worked his whole life for the Lord Cowdrey Mining Company, who came in from Mexico with Lord Cowdrey in 1904, So I said, maybe I've got a bullseye here. So I then took the memoirs with me, and I went back to the library on 42nd Street, and I decided to now look very closely at all of J.B. Body's border crossings into the United States and through Mexico. What I learned and discovered was that in 1907, just as J.C. Brown had claimed that he had found the treasure on his second trip up to Mount Shasta, when I went through J.B. Body's second border crossing through Laredo, Texas, I found him coming into the country with three other engineers that were working with him in Mexico for the Lloyd Cowdrey Mining Company. So now I realized I had a bullseye that the first time he came up with his boss, who gave him permission to go back up there in 1907 to bring three civil engineers with him. One of the civil engineers he brought with him was from South Africa. One was from Germany, born in Austria, and the other fellow was born in Scotland, all working in Mexico at the time. So he brought these three engineers through the Laredo border. They got on the Union Pacific Railroad, and they took the train up to Dunsmuir, California. And from there, which was a big mining town in those days, they went 11 miles up to the mountain, where they then went up to the mountain to discover what they found up in the hollows of Mount Shasta.
Gee, well, so J.B. Body, you believe, was truly J.C. Brown?
Yes.
All right. Now, the claims, of course, are incredible. What other proof do we have that these people still reside down there? Because J.C. Brown, J.B. Body, never saw the individuals, right?
Right, but he saw the mummifications, he saw the skeletons.
Is it possible that there's nobody down there anymore?
That's a possibility. They might have moved further because of a human intervention. I will tell you this. Upon further research and study, I realized why J.B. Body and his party of civil engineers decided to keep this the secret. And basically, it was because of the American Indian. Our Native Americans knew early in the 1840s when the first colonists went through that area and told them about the people that were living in the hollows of the earth. So, in 1851, Reddick McKee, one of our colonels from the United States Army, and this is documented by his official recorder. The guy's name was George Gibbs, and you can look this up. This is on record. You can Google this. But there was a treaty to be signed with 13 of the tribes in Mount Shasta. This is in 1851. The night before, they had a big feast. The day of the signing, the soldiers said they were going to cook a big meal for the Indians, you know, for the celebration. At that meal, 3,000 braves were poisoned. They put strychnine in the beef and in the bread. There were only 150 survivors at that massacre, one of which was named Tyree Jim, which is a little boy. He was allowed to watch it. But what he said was that most of the braves died there at the signing and some on the trail on the way home, and that he and who the others that were left picked up the remains and took back the Indians back to the village to be buried.
Jeez.
In the following year, in 1852, and this is all, you can look this all up. I want anyone listening to this to challenge whatever I'm saying to research it, because they'll realize why the Indians are on reservations today. But in the 1852 census, there were only 27 Shasta Indians left in that area. Thereafter, it was decided upon by our government that all the Indians must be put on reservations to keep the most guarded secret, so that way history would not have to be rewritten.
Did they find anything that would have shown high technology?
J.C. Brown claimed that he found it. He found metal that could not be duplicated in 1900. Now, he was a civil engineer that was part of the building of the there was in Mexico at the time. He built the Trans-Isthmian Railroad at Tehuantepec, Mexico. And this railroad went across from the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific side. And this was about 10 years ahead of the Panama Canal. So here was an engineer who was very, very astute in metals, in building. And he was convinced that this was from an ancient civilization many, many thousands of years ago.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's go to East of the Rockies. Ray, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. And yes, I did feel the earthquake this morning, too.
Yeah, out there. And you're out in Taylorville, right? Illinois?
Right.
Okay.
My question slash comment would be, that story sounds a lot familiar to the story he's telling about the guy that flew his plane over Antarctica.
That was Admiral Byrd.
Admiral Byrd, correct, yes.
And met some people there in the earth or something similar to it. And it makes me think that this is not an isolated type thing, that maybe this is, you know, quite a few places around the globe that this could be happening.
There are many places that that this is happening. If you, and I've read the Hollow Earth theory, and as a matter of fact, I read it after I wrote this manuscript that I wrote and this research, but the Admiral Byrd theory came thereafter. But I said, you know, it's interesting that this comes up because our planes today aren't allowed to fly over the North or South Pole. You know, no commercial flights are allowed, and you just wonder why.
Did they have some kind of light source, according to J.C. Brown? I mean, if you look at, you know, the Journey to the Center of the Earth movie, there was a little sun in the center, the core.
Well, He did, in the legend, he did not make reference to that. So in everything that I got, I would say I can't say unequivocally yes or say no. I was not made privy to that information by the research that I got. That I don't know.
So we don't know if they had an energy source that created light. We just don't know.
Right. What we do know is that there was a civilization that he claimed, he found there, that was ancient. He claimed they were Lemurian, and he claimed that they were technically advanced civilization that was still living within the hollows of the earth.
And they may still be there.
Yes.
West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Oh, hi, George.
Hey.
Yeah, I had a brief comment and a question.
Sure.
Also, it does sound like the story of the guy that in Death Valley that stumbled on some stuff and tried to mark the entrance and then couldn't find it. Sounded a lot like that story. But I was wondering if you were familiar with James Churchward, and he'd written a bunch of volumes of books on Mu. My mother was a Rosicrucian. She had them in her house. They described different kinds of beings that lived under there that supposedly they had left. Some of them had left. But one type of being was about 7 foot tall, and it had instead of eyes, they had like a light-sensitive gland across their forehead. And I didn't take James Churchward very seriously, but then a friend of my sister's who knew nothing, had never heard of Lemuria, went up to Mount Shasta, and she was wandering around on the mountain, and she felt this high intelligence that kind of scared her. And she looked over the top of the bushes, and there were these 7 foot high beings with no eyes and a gland across their forehead, and she immediately sunk into this sleep and woke up a couple hours later. And the next day she found a cave that was illuminated. She couldn't find the source of illumination, and she felt the same kind of high energy. She went home and told her boyfriend, and he knew about Lemuria. He ran up there, and of course nothing happened to him. But I was kind of surprised that, because I didn't really believe those books when I read them when I was a teenager at my mother's house. But I wondered if you're familiar with James Churchward.
Well, I'm familiar with him because in my research, that was one of the books that I pulled to understand Lemuria. Because once I discovered that this individual did exist, he went up to the mountain, I was able to figure out actually how it happened. I said, well, now let me look more into the research, because J.B. Body claimed, or J.C. Brown claimed, that he spent 30 years researching Lemuria. So Churchward's books was one of the first books that I was able to research, and I read that almost from cover to cover to understand what I was really dealing with in writing this story.
Somewhere along the line, there's got to be a family of J.B. Body or J.C. Brown, and they may know more about this, Stephen.
Well, it would be J.B. Body, and he died in Scotland. His heirs were in Scotland. I have here in front of me, I have his memoirs that I pulled from the book I told you about. But in the memoirs, at the end of it, it talks about, you know, his wife was the one who was left, and his son had died before that. But here, I'll read it to you.
Sure.
John Benjamin Body was born on February 27, 1867, at Megavessey, Cornwall, England. He was the son of John and Mary Ann Harris Body. He was educated at the City of London College under Professor Harry Adams. So he was an educated man. He spent 6 years of training in Great Britain. He then proceeded to Mexico and worked for the Lloyd Cowdrey Mining Company until his death. He devoted his whole life to the interest of one firm from 1890 to 1940. And he identified himself with Lloyd Pearson and Son Limited Civil Engineering Contractors, which, as I mentioned earlier, Lord Wheatman Pearson became the first Viscount Cowdrey, and that's where the Lloyd Cowdrey name came from, Lloyd Cowdrey Mining Company.
So what's next? The book? The movie? What will happen to the legend of J.C. Brown?
Well, right now, I'm trying to get my agent to find me someone to make the movie. This is... I was on the Susan Northrup show 2 weeks ago, which I know you've had her on your show before.
Yeah, yeah.
And she had told me 30 years ago, George, that I was going to write a book. I was in her audience. She picked me out of the audience, believe it or not. And she said that 30 years later, I was in midlife, I was going to write a story that was going to be very well received by the world, and that a man by the name of Michael would help me.
I'll tell you what. Get some more information to producer Lisa for me, Stephen, and I'll try to send it to a couple people I know as well that might be able to help you. It's an incredible story. Stephen Sandoni, our guest. I'll be back in a moment now. Open lines on Coast to Coast AM.